greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Privateer Issue 511, the world economy, right after this. Hey, with an income of $50,000 a year, you're paying about $7,650 in Social Security taxes if you're paying the self-employment 15.3%. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of the $50,000 twice? But the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax. Then they make you pay 17% of that same $50,000 in income tax. So that means that you're paying 17% of the $7,650 Social Security tax twice. And you know that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from everyone who pays that tax. Now, what would you think if Sears or Penny's or your credit card company charged you twice like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that's just real special. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the privateer. The Privateer is a publication that comes out of Australia. It's a newsletter. It's an economic newsletter. It costs $130 a year, American, $180 Australian. And oftentimes people will write in and say, boy, that is gloom and doom. I guess last time I told you about the Titanic story, I guess if you came to somebody on the Titanic in 1912 and said, this ship is going to sink, that would be gloom and doom. But would you rather know 48 hours in advance this ship's going to hit an iceberg and sink, or would you rather be awakened out of a sound sleep and have somebody tell you to put on your life jacket, we don't know what's happening next? Well, frankly, I would rather know what's happening. I want to know what's going on around me. That's why I subscribe to Franklin Sanders Money Changer, and I subscribe to the Privateer, and a number of other, Don McIlvaney is another one, James Cook is another one, because I want to know what's going on. I can listen to guys like Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather, just like you can, free. I can listen to PBS and the Lair News Hour. Listen, I can watch Shields and Brooks arguing about two bonesmen and whether or not we should vote for the Democrat or the Republican. I hear that just like you do. But then, besides all of the hyperbole and all of the pablum that we get, there's reality out there. So when we have an economy that's not creating jobs and we have inflation, and we have a money supply that's increasing from $3.5 trillion in 87 to $13.5 trillion, that impacts upon me. I want to know who's doing this and why and what's the ultimate outcome going to be. What's the likely outcome? Has this ever occurred before in history? What happened when the Germans did it in 1923? What happened when the Argentines did this in 2002? How did the Chinese and the Japanese fare out during the Great Depression of the 1930s? That's why I interviewed more than 80 people, my Aunt Bessie and my Uncle Buster, and Frank Rocha and Russell Harvey. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people that went through the Great Depression. And here's the surprising part. About 25%, about 20 of those 80, made money off of the Depression. Many of the people who lived through the Depression got through it pretty nicely. For instance, here in the Ozarks, there's an old adage that goes around, we never knew there was a Depression. Why, it was so poor here before the Depression that when the Depression came, we never noticed. Well, there's a little merit to that, and I've mentioned that a time or two. I started working at age 15 at the hardest dairy in the Eel River Valley. It was Frank Roach's on Lighthouse Road. He was still farming with horses in 1955, and Walter Bugnutis said to me, you might as well turn around and go back to Eureka. You'll never make it at Roach's. He told me that. Punk, pimply-faced kid. A high school kid, probably about the 9th or 10th grade, looking for a job for the summer. You'll never make it at Roach's. Well, I made it 3 years, and I left Roach's, and I went to a higher-paying job, paid $50 a month more, fed a little better, too. Mary Tritelli was a better cook than Frank Roach's wife, so I made a double step up, more money and better food. And it was the easiest place to work in the valley. But let me tell you, if I'd have started at Bill Trutelli's, where we had pipelines, bulk tanks, and hydraulics, and then went over to Frank Roach's, I'd have never made it. But because I started at Roach's, by the time I got to Trutelli's, the easiest place in the valley, life for me has always been downhill. So I feel sorry for people that started at Trutelli's and are trying to finish up at Roach's. You'd be better off if you'd have started at Roach's and finished at Trutelli's. And old Frank Roach's lent me a piece of advice. He said, if you went to the Azores, if you had to go back to Portugal today, 1955, and if you had to live and make your living there, you would starve to death. But he said, any Portuguese can come here to the United States and make it easy. Americans cannot work for minimum wage, and we won't. But a Mexican can come in here from Mexico at $5 an hour, get lied to, stolen from, and send half of his money back to Mexico and think that he's in paradise. Why is it that immigrants can come to America and make it big and make it easy? That's because Americans start at Bill Trutelli's. And when the next Great Depression comes, we are going to starve to death because we will not know how to make it. The people that will make it and make it easy will be the Amish. It'll be the Mexican immigrants. Because where they came from, it is so tough. When it gets tough here, they won't know that there's a problem. Now, let's take a look inside the United States. You know, Americans are being tragically badly treated by their political establishment. The establishment, which has chosen to place President Bush and Senator Kerry forward to be voted for on November 2nd. What the September 30th debate demonstrated clearly is that, in regard to first principles, the two contenders are in exact and full political agreement about the U.S. attack and the occupation of Iraq. So nothing's going to change there, no matter who's elected. Neither of the candidates is prepared to retreat from Iraq, which means that the U.S. occupation will continue, in total defiance of Senator Kerry's repeated statement that the war and the occupation of Iraq was a colossal error made by President Bush. Senator Kerry will continue the error. Oh, he's going to continue the error differently, whatever differently means. The smallest and the smallness of their stature is the thing that is so underwhelming. On Election Day, on November the 2nd, Americans face a no-choice election. No matter who wins, the occupation and wars in the Middle East will go on. Therefore, it's not the classical case of having to choose between two evils, and then by default making the enforced choice of the lesser evil. Here, tragically, it's only a case of having to choose between two lesser men. The president is fixed in position by his own previous military actions, and Kerry, who has so very clearly stated that he too knows of no way out, will therefore also continue the grim battles in Iraq while holding out the prospect that he can make nice with the continental European nations so as to get them to come into Iraq militarily, send troops, so that, as he has so clearly stated, the U.S. can pull our forces out. Hang on a second. The Germans and the French were pretty adamant about not getting involved in Iraq. After all, they had their own under-the-table deals with Saddam Hussein, stealing from the United Nations oil for food program. So Bush came in there and squirreled their sweetheart deal with the United Nations and Saddam Hussein. Kerry, who says this is the wrong war at the wrong time and the wrong place, is going to go over to Germany and France and get them to join up and take our place in Iraq. Do you believe that? I think they're a little smarter than that. And if you believe that, I have this bridge to sell. Now, the core military problem for the United States in its present occupation of Iraq is that it has woefully insufficient troops on the ground to come even close to a successful military occupation. How many troops would be needed to stabilize Iraq? Well, the highly respected International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, before which the president spoke last November, their conclusion was that it would take 500,000 troops on the ground to stabilize Iraq. 500,000, half a million. Now, U.S. Army Chief of Staff Eric Shinseki told Congress before the war publicly that several hundred thousand troops would be needed after the war was concluded, and he was asking for 400,000, and he was shown the door and fired after having made that statement. Now, there have been just under 1,000 attacks in Baghdad alone this past month. That's September. 1,000 attacks. An American military spokesman has said this week that since April, insurgents have fired nearly 3,000 mortar rounds in Baghdad alone. 3,000 mortar rounds. We Americans have rigid gun control in our country, and in Iraq, they not only are armed with automatic weapons, they've even got mortars. And you can't do anything about it. Well, that ought to tell you that there's not very much law and order going on over there. Over the past 30 days, more than 2,300 attacks by Iraqi insurgents have been directed against civilians and military targets in Iraq in a pattern that sprawls over nearly every major population center outside the Kurdish north. Down south in the British sector, close to Basra, in August alone, the British expended 100,000 rounds of ammunition in Mazen province at Amara, saying that they had encountered the most intense fighting since the Korean War. So here are the British. Down south, around Basra, they fired 100,000 rounds and said this is the toughest fighting that we've been engaged in, including the Falklands War, since Korea. I might point out to you that in 1921, the Iraqis forced the British to quit Iraq. Did you know that? Yeah, see, the British, right after World War I, they took Iraq away from Turkey. And they installed a king over there, a little puppet government, and that government and his successors were in office for quite a few years, and the British were over there occupying Iraq, and the insurgency then in the 1920s threw them out. I doubt seriously that these insurgents are going to quit. I don't think you're going to put them down. You didn't put them down in 1921. What makes you think you're going to do it in 2000? So the bottom line is, these people have something to fight for. They're not fighting for oil. We're over there stealing their oil. They're over there fighting for their own national sovereignty. They've got a cause to fight for. That's tough to overcome. People with a cause fight and die, and they don't care about their lives. They're willing to give up their lives. Americans aren't. Every night on the news, Dan Rather will show the picture of some American killed in Iraq. Well, what's he doing that for? It's to turn Americans against the war. The truth of the matter is, not very many Americans have died in the war. I mean, Americans died by the tens of thousands in World War II. You got 1,000 here in Iraq. You haven't got enough to talk about, and so what they do is they show individuals. The Lair NewsHour does the same thing. I don't know if it's popular or good. It's demoralizing to the American people, and it's demoralizing to the war effort. If you want to defeat America, this is the way to do it. Turn Americans against the war. Dan Rather and Jim Lehrer could not be doing a greater service for the enemies of America than to turn Americans against the war. Now, Americans, now that you're in the war, you're either going to win or you're going to lose. One or the other. You're going to win or you're going to lose. And if we can demoralize you, you're probably going to lose. And after all, that's what your enemies want, isn't it? Now, it's sad when somebody gets killed, but you know, Joe Stalin put his finger right on the pulse of reality. He said, when one person dies, it's a tragedy. But when a million people die, it's a statistic. So when 400,000 people die in World War II, I don't think it was that many, 200,000 Americans, I think it was, 200,000 to 400,000 Americans died in World War II, I forgot exactly. That's a statistic. But when Dan Rather shows you the name, the address, I don't know if they got the telephone number on there, but the age and the picture of a soldier that died, that's a tragedy. And they put that on every single night for you to watch, to demoralize you, to destroy your will to resist. That's, after all, what war is all about. If Americans stay in Iraq, and to hell with the casualties, you Americans will eventually win the military action. It may take 30,000 American dead to win, but in the final analysis, Ulysses Grant put his finger on the pulse of victory for the Yankees in the Civil War when he said this. He said that the Southern fighters were better soldiers, and that they could kill, and that they were killing, two Yankees for every Confederate soldier that the Yankees could kill. And he said, ultimately, we will win the war because we have four times the population of the Southern states. So every time they kill two Yankees, we'll kill one Southerner, and in the end, we will win the war. And if America goes after Iraq with that attitude, America will win the war. But I don't think Americans any longer have the stomach for war. Americans are soft, fat, flatulent, and weak. Oh, I'm not talking about the 130,000 volunteers that are over there. Those guys are tough. I'm talking about the 535 members of the Congress of the United States. There's only one of them that has one son in Iraq. The other 534 are fat, lazy, and weak. Now, World War II was a different brand of war. George Bush Sr. was a fighter pilot in the Navy. Shot down once, I heard. Bob Dole was wounded in action, crippled for the rest of his life. Americans in World War II were tough as nails. Americans were going to defeat Germany and Japan if it took every last damn drop of blood in America to do it. But that's not Iraq in 2004. Americans don't have that kind of resolve today. Americans enter Iraq today not to fight for America. They're there to fight for $100,000 a year, which is a guaranteed salary or a guaranteed pay, tax-free for Halliburton. Of course, you got soldiers fighting over there and dying for nickels on the dollar, but the defense contractors are making millions and billions of dollars. We're there for the money. We're not there for any principle. Now, our enemies are fighting for principle. We're over there stealing their oil, and they're going to fight for what's theirs. Right's right, and wrong's wrong. It's hard to fight from the left side of the issue. It's another reason why Americans are going to be defeated. In the end. Not because you don't have the military power to do it. It's because you don't have the will to do it. That's not every American, that's just most Americans. Now, reports covering 7 days in a recent 10-day period depicted a nation racked by all manner of insurgent violence, from complex ambushes involving 30 guerrillas north of Baghdad on Monday to children tossing Molotov cocktails at a U.S. Army patrol in the capital's Sadr City slum on Wednesday. Attacks over the past 2 weeks have killed more than 250 Iraqis and 29 U.S. military personnel. According to figures released by the Pentagon, these are just short takes from volumes of reports from Iraq, but they are descriptive of the actual situation there and show the unviability of the occupation. And of course, these reports are barely to be seen inside the United States by our media. Let me tell you a little story here about the Iraqi soccer players. They kicked the stuffing out of Bush's fantasy. With just 70 days until Election Day, the race for the presidency has gone from bitter to outright poisonous. Now, this is 8/26, 70 days. We're down to about 30 days or 3 weeks now. 3 weeks, I guess, as I speak to you. Well, John Kerry is faulted in television ads by President Bush's moneyed allies for winning combat medals in a war that Bush avoided, then slammed by the same hypocrites for having the courage to criticize that war after his return as a wounded vet. Meanwhile, Bush pretends to be above the fray, all the while parading as a war commander and boasting bizarrely about his mythical achievements in the invasion of Iraq. That war, like Vietnam, has been a costly disaster since its inception. In an eerie echo of previous presidents who knowingly lied to us and lied us into the Vietnam War, always affirming that victory was just around the corner, Bush's latest campaign ads prematurely declare Afghanistan and Iraq as the world's newest democracies. According to the implicit logic of one ad, the proof can be found in the fact that they both sent teams to the Olympics. Well, never mind that both countries are racked by insurgencies and warlordism, and are both dependent on U.S. troops for what passes for security, but Both countries are under martial law, and their leaders are unelected U.S. appointees. So cover your eyes to the fact that both countries are squalid economic basket cases, with the vast majority of their population unemployed, or, as in the case of Afghanistan, cultivating opium poppies. And now ignore the facts. They're democracies because George W. Bush says so. But members of the very successful Iraqi Olympic soccer team beg to differ, blasting Bush's attempts to use their participation in the games as justification for the U.S. occupation of their country. "My problems are not with the American people," Iraqi's soccer coach Adnan Hamid Mojeed told the Associated Press. "My problem is with what America has done to my country in Iraq, destroying everything. The American army has killed so many people in Iraq." His star midfielder, Salih Sadar, agreed, "Iraq as a team doesn't want Mr. Bush to use us in an ad for the presidential campaign for his reelection. We do not wish for the presence of Americans in our country. We want them to go away." They're not anonymous bomb throwers sending notes to the media. These are Iraq's favorite sons. These are the stars of the national sport, and yet they all, to a man, seem to be saying the same thing. America's military is not wanted on our land. And another team member, Ahmad Minajed, demanded to know, "How will Bush meet his God, having slaughtered so many men and women? He has committed so many crimes." The athlete added that were it not playing for his country, he would for sure be fighting in the Iraqi resistance. Now, one of their team members said, "If I wasn't here in the Olympics, I'd be fighting the Americans. I want to defend my home. If a stranger invades America and the people resist, does that mean they're terrorists?" Think about that. That's an Iraqi. He says, "Hey, listen, if we came over and attacked you, we're terrorists. Well, what are you when you come over and attack us?" Now, that's a legitimate question that no one in the Bush administration and very few in Congress want to grapple with. And yet we wonder why, 15 months after the United States liberated Iraq, why is it that there are so many people there who hate us? Now, the honest answer would be similar to the one once offered by Vietnam. Vietnam vet and now Secretary of State Colin Powell to explain the failure of the U.S. occupation of South Vietnam. Powell said, quote, "We had been sent to pursue a policy that had become bankrupt." Powell wrote in his autobiography, quote, "Our political leaders had lied to us and got us involved in a war for the one-size-fits-all rationale of anti-communism, which was only a partial fit in Vietnam, where the war had its own historical roots in nationalism, anti-colonialism, and civil strife beyond the East-West conflict." The only essential difference between Powell's remarks and the 1971 remarks by Kerry that Bush supporters cite in their ugly smear campaign is that Powell's dissent came 20 years too late to stop the carnage. And those who attack Kerry for speaking out in 71 against the Vietnam War don't understand that it was an enormous public service for returning American veterans to expose the cynicism of their leaders, as Kerry did in testifying before the U.S. Senate. So no matter what your opinion, it's the Iraqis that have something to fight for and are in fact fighting for a cause. Americans are over in Iraq fighting to make $100,000 a year or to make money off the contracts. They're not there because there's some cause that we're fighting for like we did in World War II or World War I. Now, the Iraqis defeated the English in 1921, and I would predict that they'll defeat the Americans in 2004 or 2005. Stand by, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and the Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax. And a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, we all know that governments tax us and everything that wiggles, moves, and squirms, but what is it that government actually does to produce, prepare, or deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Now, does the pizza parlor make 38% profit on the pizza that they buy the ingredients to make, prepare, cook, serve, and pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Well, why is it the government then gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and service that you and I buy? Well, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school here at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is also available on compact disc for adult home study. That's the school. You can do it at home. And if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. While we're talking about the politics of Iraq, I got a letter in here the other day and said, you know that you're decidedly Republican or pro-Bush? No, I'm the one that said for the last 3 years since the Patriot Act was enacted that George Bush should be turned out of office on the Patriot Act alone. That's how egregious that piece of legislation is. Now, am I a pro-Kerry? No, I'm not pro-Kerry or anti-Kerry. And when I told this guy, I said, you know, I'm neutral. He said, no, you're partisan. Well, let me tell you something. I'm not going to vote in the 2004 election. I didn't vote in the 2000 election. I didn't vote in 96, 92, 88, 84, 80. I mean, I can count back for about the last 30 years. I did vote a couple of times, but that was before I woke up. No, I'm neutral when it comes to voting, and every journalist who votes in the upcoming election is a partisan. Dan Rather is probably partisan in this election. I'll just bet you that Dan Rather is going to vote, and I think he's going to vote for John Kerry. So when I tell you that I'm here to report facts, I have reported many facts about George Bush that are favorable, but I've reported, I think, many facts. I don't know if it's more or less, but many facts that are favorable to John Kerry. You know, Bush was the guy that shirked and reneged on the war. He was like Bill Clinton. He got out of the war by getting into the National Guard. I just mentioned a little while ago, there was a time when we did have Americans that actually got their butts out and went to work and fought for their country. Kerry's one of them. I mean, you can sit there and argue that he did it on purpose so that he could get wounded in battle, or that he could get into the war so he could run for president, I guess. I don't know what his motivation was. But he was over in Vietnam, and he was over there where they were shooting real bullets and they were actually getting shot at. I mean, you sit there and argue all you want about the difference between the two, but George Bush played it safe here in the States, and if he hadn't got into the National Guard, he'd have probably gone to Oxford like Clinton did over in England, or run off to Canada or something else. No, I don't think Bush was a hero in the Vietnam War. I don't know that Kerry was or wasn't, but Kerry was at least in the fracas. Now take a look at your Congress today. You know, Kerry came from wealth. You know, he wasn't filthy rich, but his dad was in the civil service. He wasn't poor, upper middle class. And he took his burden. He went to war, and that's what That's what Americans have done for the last 200 years. You know, we used to go to war. We used to, my dad went to World War II. And most of the Gordons that I know of have all served in World War I or World War II or Vietnam, or not Vietnam, but Korea. Or the Spanish-American War or the Civil War. General Bill Gordon, you know, was fighting for the South in the Civil War. We had Gordons on both sides in the Civil War. We're not pacifists. The Gordons have a clan in the British Army, you know, that are called the Gordon Highlanders. Now, the Gordons have a long military tradition and history. We're all killers. But when I come on the air and I tell you, no, listen. Listen, boys and girls, pay attention. There's cause and effect over here. The real problem in the world today is economics. The world economy is on the verge of collapse. The war in Iraq is a distraction. Terrorism, the war on terrorism is a distraction. The number of people that are killed by terrorists over here are dropping the bucket. Why, we commit 2.5 million abortions in this country. We're not concerned with lives in America. That's poppycock. Lives mean nothing here. Lives are simply birth control. Don't give me this crap about, oh, we're just real concerned about the lives of Americans. No, you're not. Not at all. I don't care which side of that issue you're on either. Americans are more concerned about euthanizing dogs and cats than they are human beings. And that's just where reality is. Now, we're trying to put a human face on the war in Iraq for the purpose of demoralizing Americans to defeat them. And America will surely be defeated in Iraq. And Deuteronomy 28 tells us why. And it's because we won't obey God and keep His commandments. America has not just become amoral. We are doing everything in our power to be as immoral as we possibly can. I mean, we work at being as filthy and perverted as we can possibly be. That's where you get 28 million sodomites in the nation, 2.5 million abortions a year. I mean, you know, there's a limit to how far this is going to go. And Iraq is just a pimple on the elephant's trunk for what's coming. That's why I suggest that you subscribe to, I know it's $180 Australian, but you know, I suggest you subscribe to Reality instead of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. Subscribe to the Privateer. For crying out loud, if you want a dose of reality, at least subscribe to Mad Magazine. You'll get more truth out of Mad Magazine than you're going to get out of the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal. Well, I suggest The Privateer is published by William A.M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, Australia, 4567 is the zip code. Now, before you send the money, I would suggest that you send him an email. It's capt@the-privateer.com. Again, that's capt@the-privateer.com, and they've got a web page, so why don't you go to www.the-privateer.com, take a look at their web page. On September 29th, the U.S. Congress passed a stopgap bill to keep the government running into November as Republicans admitted that they could not finish their budget work. The House of Representatives voted 389-32 to support the bill to fund government programs outside defense at the 2004 level until November the 20th. Now, notice that that's conveniently after the election. This is the technique used to avoid raising the national debt limit. That's not good during an election. So what we're going to do is quietly pass a bill to fund at the 2004 level. See, we're in the 2005 fiscal year. Starts October the 1st. The Senate then approved it unanimously. There is still no budget in place. Now let's take a look at China and Japan. Japan's trade surplus fell 26% in August from a year ago. They still have a trade surplus, but it fell 26%. The first decline in 14 months. Western politicians might be full of soothing words, but businesses across the West are not buying into the political spiel. This can be seen from this latest report from the United States. U.S. capital goods orders fell 7.4%. Capital goods. That's tools and equipment, machinery, new factories. This was the biggest drop in new U.S. capital investment since the 12.3% decline in September of 2002. In both Japan and the United States, businesses are scaling back their capital investments. That is the classical signal, based upon past economic history, that businesses see recession on the horizon, and they're scaling back now because they don't want to be caught with a lot of idle equipment or inventory. So they're going to buzz off that inventory, and they're going to scale back on future plant and equipment expansion. And that's because sales are soft. So a business is looking at sales. Sales depend upon consumers. Now, 67% of America's economy is based upon consumerism, not production. We're not producing and exporting. That's the Chinese and Japanese that are producing and exporting. And the Chinese have piled up $450 billion in surplus. And they're out here spending those dollars on capital businesses. They're getting rid of it. They're going to buy real estate or buy something. Good thinking for them. They might as well get something because they're not going to get paid for the American dollars that they've taken in. America's not going to pay them. We're going to default. Now, Chinese officials dined with the finance ministers, treasurers, and central bankers of the United States, France, Japan, Germany, and the United Kingdom, Italy, and Canada on October the 1st. That was following the G7 meeting in Washington. Now, China is the last man standing in terms of having its central bank absorb the accelerating inflow of U.S. dollars and then lending them right back to the United States to keep us solvent. But for the past 6 weeks, China has started doing a lot of different things with its hoard of U.S. dollars and U.S. Treasury debt paper. China is now using those dollars to buy up larger resource companies and resources around the world, in Canada, Australia, South Africa, America, South America. And the sellers of these companies, of course, end up holding heaps of U.S. dollars from these sales. And since most of them are not Americans, what they end up holding is not their national currency. And so they appear as sellers of the U.S. dollar across the world's currency floors. So when China goes to Germany and buys a business or buys real estate, they get rid of the dollars. The guy that takes the dollars and sells his property now takes those dollars into the currency traders, the banks, and trades those dollars in for euros. That way nobody picks up on the fact that it's the Chinese that are unloading those dollars. So that increases the supply of the U.S. dollars, which are circulating around the world, placing it under increasing strain and adding to the risks of a sudden and large fall in the value of the U.S. dollar. Further, by acting this way and buying up global resource companies, China avoids being seen as a global seller of U.S. dollars. It's the sellers of resource and resource companies who show up after the sale and sell across the currency floors. Those are the guys that take the blame. Now, the Chinese aren't stupid. They see what's coming down. But in their own self-interest, they've been caught between a rock and a hard spot. Now, if you've been paying attention, and you can do this, you can go back to our archives and you can listen to my reports on the privateer over the past year. And if you'll listen to those reports on the privateer over the past year, you'll see that these boys down in Australia have been telling us that the world's economy is on a razor edge. It is about to collapse. It is weak. This isn't something that came up in the last 48 hours. It's been going on now for a year. If you go back for the last 3 or 4 years, you'll see that I've been reporting that the world's economy has not been good. And even in the 1990s, when boom times were here, that never was good for America. The WTO, GATT, NAFTA, those were diversions. That was bad. But we bought into it. Free trade. We bought into it. And now there's a penalty to pay. There's a time when the day of reckoning comes, and we're just about there. Now, there's opportunities out there. Not only is there a day of reckoning, but there's also opportunity. Now, China has also been seen in the global oil market buying up tanker loads of oil. But they didn't stop there. China also bought the tankers. This is a geopolitical fit with many recent semi-official statements coming out of China to the effect that the Chinese government wants to increase China's strategic oil reserves. China only has 10 to 12 days of stock in hand compared to the 120 days of oil which Japan holds in its reserves. So China has a real problem. It does not have sufficient facilities on land to store anywhere near the 60 to 80 day strategic oil reserve that they're now talking about. So that points straight towards simply parking these newly bought tankers in some nearby ports. So watch what the Chinese are doing now. They need a stockpile of oil so that when this collapse comes, they've got something, a cushion to sit back on. Now, the world doesn't go through collapse forever. It goes through a collapse and then as rapid a reorganization as possible. So there's a dislocation that occurs. Sometimes it's a few months, sometimes it's a few years. So we here at the Law Hour recommend that you have a reserve of 4 years. Just like World War II, you know, you may have a tough road to hoe. How would you like to be in downtown Baghdad this afternoon? I want to get as far away from that place as I can get. Now, don't you think that people 2 years ago, before America attacked, knew that war was coming? Didn't everybody know in November, December of 2002 that we were about to go to war against Iraq? Well, what if you knew that an economic collapse was coming? Can't you see? Are you dull of hearing? Are your eyes blinded? Can't you read the reports? Why would anybody want to buy dollars? Why would anybody want to go out today and buy a $250,000 house? Now, I tell you, boys and girls, if you've got a $250,000 house, this is the time when you want to sell it and turn your equity into cash. Turn the cash into gold, bury it in a hole in the ground, because when the collapse comes, do you think that house is going to be selling for $250,000? Or will it be selling for $200,000? Or $150,000? Or $100,000? Or $50,000? Or $25,000? Then a reorganization comes, like we saw in Russia here just 2 or 3 years ago. They just changed the color of their currency, devalued it, and went on from there. Those that are holding the old currency get burned. Too bad for you. Now, those are a little tougher to come by. Can't you read the tea leaves? Can't you see that the American dollar is losing value? Can't you see that the American dollar is going to be devalued? When? I don't know. I'm not a prophet and I'm not an insider. You know, Jesus, the Messiah, made an observation in Matthew 24. He said, You people are unable to read the signs of the times. Aren't you reading the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post? They're reporting these facts. They're just not telling you what these facts mean. The guy here in the privateer says, listen, boys and girls, let me tell you what's going on. Pay attention. Let me explain to you what the outcome of this is going to be. History repeats itself. History repeats itself, and the people that can't learn from history then have to learn from their own mistakes by repeating history's mistakes. Let's take a page out of Germany's 1923. Let's take a page out of Argentina 2002. And let's see if we can't come out a little better in this game. I'm not going to prevent it. I'm not going to get a whole bunch of people to vote for this guy or that and save America. The Titanic has already hit the ice. It's going to sink. We just don't know when. Do you have your deck chairs up in the bow of the ship? Are you standing in front of lifeboat six? Are you a woman or a child, or are you a man? I mean, come on, guys. Let's start thinking. Now, here's a little bit of monetary history. You know, historically, what China is now doing appears to be a very near parallel with the technique that was used in West Germany after World War II, as a wave after wave of U.S. dollars rolled in during the 1960s and 70s. Initially, the Germans bought U.S. Treasury paper, but later, to the increasing irritation of the American officials who were spending their time in West Germany complaining to the Germans about the German trade surplus with the United States, they set up a system where any German business which wanted to make investments in new plant or equipment in other parts of the world could change their Deutschmarks at a very small discount for the U.S. dollars which kept arriving, and then use these U.S. dollars as the means of payment for their new foreign investments. So in that manner, the West Germans re-exported those U.S. dollars as fast as they arrived. So they sold Volkswagens for U.S. dollars, then turned around and spent those U.S. dollars, and in the process avoided funding the U.S. Treasury or piling up ever bigger hoards of U.S. dollars in the basement of the Bundesbank. It did wonders to the Deutschmark and the Mark's reputation worldwide. So if the Chinese have discovered this old West German monetary technique, then they're starting a process in which, as fast as U.S. dollars arrive in China, they go right back out again as China makes global investments and unloads its unwanted U.S. dollars. Now, that's what the Chinese are doing right now. Now, Warren Buffett also is unloading dollars. Now, does that send you a signal? Because if it doesn't, it sure ought to. But that spells opportunity. Is Warren Buffett wringing his hands and saying, oh my gosh, I'm going to sell my dollars, dig a hole, crawl into it, and pull it in over me? No, he's out there making money. He's buying other currencies. George Soros, he's another billionaire. He's unloading dollars, and he makes his money in currency. I'm not here to speculate in currency or to tell you what to do or how to do it. I'm just telling you that I don't care whether the market's going up or the market's going down. Opportunity is like rain. It's everywhere. And you just need to learn how to take advantage of those opportunities. Now, we teach a business school here at the law school. And in that business school, I have about 84 business principles that I've picked up over the years by interviewing people who were successful in business. People who succeeded in the Great Depression in making money. In a time when Americans had 25% unemployment, there were other Americans out there making money, buying, selling, trading, and doing quite well for themselves. Other Americans protected their assets from confiscation and foreclosure. Now, if people could do that in the Depression years of the 1930s in America once, why can't we do that again in Depression America a second time? Well, I think we can. And I think you ought to be thinking about that. Let's get busy and see if there isn't something more intelligent and more constructive to do. If Warren Buffett and George Soros are unloading American dollars, if the Chinese are unloading the dollars and buying, using those dollars to buy up everything that's in sight, they're buying oil. Do you know why oil is in short supply? The Chinese are buying it up and storing it. If there's any spare oil out there at $50 a barrel, the Chinese are willing to spend $50 a barrel on it. They're not burning it, they're storing it. They're buying the whole oil tankers. If they don't have the storage tanks to unload the oil into off the tankers, we'll just buy the tanker, it's a storage tank, tie it up in a port, and sit back and wait. The oil isn't going to get any cheaper. And if it does, so what? We're going to burn it up here anyway. We're going to use it someday. That's why I tell people, you know, you're better off buying toilet paper. You know, you'd be better off to take your dollars and buy toilet paper and stick it in the basement or up in your attic. You're going to use it someday. But if you hang on to the dollars and the dollar depreciates, I showed you that last time, the dollar depreciates by 20%. That toilet paper that costs you a dollar is going to cost you $1.20. Then it'll cost you not $1.20, but it'll cost you maybe a dollar and a half. You're losing purchasing power is what the bottom line is. Don't think that you're going to get rich on 1 or 2% interest in the bank. Now, inside the European Union, we'll take a look at that next time. Europe. They keep track of things in Europe. And when the collapse comes, the euro is not going to collapse with the dollar. The currencies of other nations around the world are also fiat currencies, and ultimately they're going to lose value and be dragged down, but they're not going to be dragged down, they're not going to be destroyed all at once. Now, the American dollar has already been destroyed. From its value in the 1930s to what it is today, it's lost 96.5% of its value. What we're talking about now is the loss of the last 3.5 cents. Is it going to be a slow, orderly, over time depreciation, or is it going to happen suddenly and swiftly like it just happened down in Argentina? Well, I'm betting on the Argentine scenario. I'm about out of time. We'll come back next time and we'll take a look at inside the European Union and what the Europeans are doing. We'll take a look at Australia, what the Australian report is next time. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, and we're heard worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal that says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.